Good evening, I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu calls on the U.S. to stand with Israel in a speech to Congress that many Democrats boycotted.
President Biden addresses the nation for the first time since dropping out of the presidential race.
And as the country works to address its youth mental health crisis, another troubling trend emerges. More young Black Americans are attempting to take their own lives.
One of the primary reasons they've pointed to is feeling hopeless about the future. Hopelessness on an individual level, but also hopelessness on a structural level.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu defended the war in Gaza today in a speech to a joint meeting of Congress amid protests and partisan politics that led dozens of Democrats to boycott the speech.
Netanyahu disparaged protesters who clashed with police outside the U.S. Capitol and blamed Hamas for the tens of thousands of Palestinians killed in Israel's nine-month war in Gaza since the October 7th terrorist attack. Nick Schifrin reports.
His Excellency Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel. Thank you.
No other foreign leader has delivered as many congressional addresses or received as much State of the Union-style applause, but no other invited foreign leader has also driven such division. Outside Congress today, protesters burned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in effigy and spray-painted Hamas is coming. At one point, police pepper-sprayed demonstrators after they became violent. Dozens of Democrats boycotted, and some attending did not stand. But Republican lawmakers and many Democrats showered their support as Netanyahu portrayed Iran as a mutual enemy.
When Israel acts to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons that could destroy Israel and threaten every American city, every city that you come from, we're not only protecting ourselves, we're protecting you.
As Israeli soldiers continue to battle Hamas fighters, Netanyahu has resisted endorsing a plan for the day after the war. Today, he reiterated a vision that U.S. officials have previously described as unrealistic.
Gaza should have a civilian administration run by Palestinians who do not seek to destroy Israel. That's not too much to ask. It's a fundamental thing that we have a right to demand and to receive.
There's enormous pressure on Netanyahu to agree to a deal that would release Israeli hostages. Congressional police detained some of the hostages' family members today who rose during the speech to demand he, quote, seal the deal. But today, Netanyahu announced no breakthrough and once again vowed to release all the hostages.
We're actively engaged in intensive efforts to secure their release, and I'm confident that these efforts can succeed. Some of them are taking place right now.
Since 1967,
Netanyahu has spoken to Congress before in 1996, 2011, and 2015, when he criticized President Obama's Iran nuclear deal.
It doesn't block Iran's path to the bomb. It paves Iran's path to the bomb.
But today, he praised President Biden.
And he came to Israel to stand with us during our darkest hour, a visit that will never be forgotten.
As for the protesters, Netanyahu denounced them as anti-Semites doing the bidding of Hamas and disparaged them with a term usually reserved for pro-Soviet stooges.
You have officially become Iran's useful idiots.
Since October the 7th, Palestinian health officials say more than 120,000 Palestinians have been killed or wounded. Today, Netanyahu blamed their deaths on Hamas.
For Israel, every civilian death is a tragedy. For Hamas, it's a strategy. They actually want Palestinian civilians to die so that Israel will be smeared in the international media and be pressured to end the war before it's won.
Nearly 6,000 miles away, the war continues in Khan Yunis, now a shell of itself. Gazans who were told it would be safe to come back here now must escape again, forced to drag their loved ones, too frail to walk, desperate for a safety that's nowhere to be found.
We demand the countries of the world and the leaders of the world to look at us. We are being targeted while we're being displaced.
On Monday, Israel issued evacuation orders to 400,000 Gazans in parts of Khan Yunis and the previously designated safe zone on the Mawasi. Their neighborhoods are flooded with sewage. This week, the World Health Organization warned of the spread of the polio virus. The UN says nearly one-third of those killed have been children. But somehow, baby Malik Yassin came to life, born after his mother died in an airstrike on their family home.
After Netanyahu's speech, a senior administration official told reporters that a hostage deal is in, quote, the closing stages. But this official acknowledged there is no agreement yet between Israel and Hamas on the transition from a temporary to a permanent ceasefire. To delve more into what Netanyahu said and did not say, we're joined by Tom Malinowski, a two-term Democratic member of the House from New Jersey and a former top State Department human rights official under Barack Obama. And Kirsten Fontenrose, who served on the Trump National Security Council, focused on the Middle East, and was also an official in both the State and Defense Departments. Welcome to NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. Thanks very much to you both. Kirsten Fontenrose, let me start with you. What did you think of Benjamin Netanyahu's speech?
I think he hit the points he came to hit. He both thanked the Biden administration, gave credit where it was due for their support for his policy, which also makes it a little harder for a Kamala Harris campaign to deviate from that policy. He also set the stage for what he hopes will be a successful meeting with former President Trump this coming Friday by thanking President Trump for the work he did during his administration. He also linked his war in Gaza against several fronts, including the Houthis and Hezbollah, with America's confrontation of Iran, essentially making the point, our war is your war. We are fighting them here, so you do not have to fight them at home. And I think that is a point that resonates on both sides of the aisle.
Tom Malinowski, is Israel's war the U.S. war?
The war against Hamas was a fight that all Americans and people all around the world were willing and happy to support Israel in waging after the just unspeakable evil of what Hamas did to innocent Israelis on that horrible day. But, you know, we often say that Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. I think Israel has also missed an opportunity. There was an opportunity to build a truly broad anti-Hamas, anti-terror, anti-Iran coalition, but it would have required Prime Minister Netanyahu to do something he's unwilling to do, and that is to meet his potential allies halfway by presenting at least a pathway to a Palestinian state, to a two-state solution. What I heard today was, okay, he was less partisan than he might have been. He was gracious to President Biden, but I heard no forward progress on the hostage issue for the families that were waiting for something. And I heard a vision for the future of the Middle East and the future of Gaza that is completely disconnected from reality. And I couldn't help thinking that as he was speaking, his own defense minister is telling us that Netanyahu is moving, is sending Israel into a very dark future. His own security establishment thinks that he's placing his own political interests ahead of the interest of the security of Israel. And I feel like if you are pro-Israel, as I am, how can you provide unconditional support and unconditional applause to a man who, according to his own security officials and most of the Israeli people, is doing so much to hurt Israel's own interests?
Kirsten Fontenrose, is Benjamin Netanyahu, as his critics say, extending the war in order to extend his own political power?
I don't think it's really up to him. Granted, the Knesset probably cannot dissolve his government while they are out of session, which ends this Sunday. But this war is being extended by the parties on the other side as readily as it is by Israel. You have the Houthis, who just recently launched new attacks using drones. Hezbollah sends about 150 rockets and missiles across that border every day. This war is being extended. It's being managed, but it's certainly already being extended.
And so, Tom, I'll ask you to respond to that. The fact is that Hezbollah opened fire itself on October the 8th and has fired hundreds or thousands of rockets into Israel. Hamas continues to attack Israelis, not only in Gaza, but inside Israel. So
they want to
Netanyahu's
extend the war.
Defenders say,
of course,
we're doing what we have to do.
They're extending. They love this situation. I mean, I agree with Netanyahu that Hamas doesn't care about Palestinian lives. But Hamas is happy to see Palestinians in Gaza die. Hezbollah is happy to see that. The Houthis are happy to see this. Iran is happy to see this. And this is why so many people inside Israel, including members of Netanyahu's own party, who are responsible day to day for the security of the state of Israel, are urging him to take the opportunity to end the conflict that is benefiting Israel's enemies. But I think he won't do it because, well, there's a political dynamic at play, and because he is ideologically against the one thing that is necessary to bring the world together to actually help him in Gaza and to create a durable solution.
Let's talk about the hostage deal itself, Kirsten von der Rose, on the table. 6 weeks would pause the war. That would be the first phase. It would release more than 30 hostages. We did not hear from Netanyahu what these hostage families who traveled to Washington, D.C. wanted to hear, some kind of full-throated endorsement of that deal. Benny Gantz, the opposition leader today, accused Netanyahu of stalling and not wanting that deal. Why do you think Netanyahu's not publicly endorsed this deal, or should he?
He did mention during his speech that even while I'm speaking, actions are being taken toward this deal, and he is sending people to negotiate again on Thursday. Some would say that's too many days away from now, but it is at least a negotiation continuing to happen. There's so many questions still left unanswered in this. Will that full withdrawal include the Philadelphia corridor, for instance?
The corridor between Gaza and Egypt.
Right, exactly. So there are a lot of real concrete details that are not ironed out yet. Who will oversee the withdrawal? Who will be holding each party accountable during this time period? A lot of these answers still need to be provided by the international community as well as by Israel and Hamas. It is argued that Hamas was the spoiler for quite some time, and now Israel is kind of dragging its feet, and there's definitely truth to that. But I think it is probably because of some of these unanswered questions. He cannot full-throatedly agree to this hostage deal without some of these questions being answered. Otherwise, he doesn't know what to tell his IDF soldiers who are sitting in Rafah waiting for the remnants of Hamas to come out of the tunnels and to take care of them if he agrees to something that unequivocally pulls them at the very end of what could be a definitive operation.
Tom Malinowski, let me ask about the protesters. Netanyahu called them, quote, useful idiots for Iran. Are they?
If you look at the protesters who are flying the Hamas flag and burning the American flag.
I think they're flying the Palestinian flag.
I would say that if Netanyahu had paid those protesters, they couldn't be more helpful to him. Because he wants to go back to Israel and say, the alternative to me is we give in to people who are calling for the destruction of the state of Israel. And so then he doesn't have to listen to the two-thirds of the Israeli public that would prefer a hostage deal to continuing the war. He doesn't have to listen to the most pro-Israel American president in history, Joe Biden, who has been trying to help him out of this situation. That said, I think he was unfairly disdainful to the many people in the United States, including people who are deeply committed to the defense of Israel, who have legitimate concerns about the humanitarian situation in Gaza.
Kirsten von der Rose, you brought up Vice President Harris. Today, she was not there. Her staff said that she had a scheduling conflict. But she has been a little bit ahead of President Biden in the past on her criticism of Israel. And let's take a listen to something that she said back in March.
People in Gaza are starving. The conditions are inhumane. And our common humanity compels us to act. And given the immense scale of suffering in Gaza, there must be an immediate ceasefire.
Kirsten von der Rose, quickly in the time we have left, Israelis believe Harris would push an end for the war in Gaza more than President Biden would. There will be a difference between Harris and Biden. Do you think they're right?
I think they are right that she might push for that, but really even a President Harris could only do so if she tied, for instance, American support to Israeli military activities to that ceasefire, and that would require approval of the Senate. So it really depends on more than just her own election.
Kirsten von der Rose, Tom Malinowski, we'll stop there. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Capitol Hill is also where we start our other headlines of the day. FBI Director Christopher Wray revealed during congressional testimony today that the gunman who tried to assassinate former President Donald Trump searched for information on the killing of President John F. Kennedy a week earlier. Ray was speaking during a House Judiciary Committee hearing as lawmakers from both parties pressed for answers on why the July 13th shooting in Butler, Pennsylvania, had not been prevented. He said the timing of the suspect's online search was significant.
Analysis of a laptop that the investigation ties to the shooter reveals that on July 6th, he did a Google search for, quote, how far away was Oswald from Kennedy? That is the same day that it appears that he registered for the Butler rally.
New body cam footage from the aftermath of the shooting shows law enforcement on the roof where the 20-year-old gunman was killed by a sniper. FBI Director Ray said the Bureau believes he acted alone, and while his motive is unclear, Ray says the gunman was interested in public figures more broadly. Climate scientists say this past Monday was Earth's hottest day ever, breaking the record set just a day earlier. According to the European Climate Service Copernicus, the global average temperature on Monday was 62.87 degrees Fahrenheit. That was 0.1 degree higher than Sunday. Scientists say the timing of these records is especially troubling, given that the El Niño climate pattern, which warms the Central Pacific Ocean, ended earlier this year.
We've seen the signal come back to neutral, and almost La Nina, actually. La Nina means there's substantial cooling happening. And so then we would really expect the temperatures to come down. And so if that is not happening, then it means there's really, really, really something wrong happening in our planet.
The heat wave has fanned the flames of summer wildfires, especially in the West. The largest blaze in the country is in Oregon, which has burned nearly 400 square miles. Other fires are scorching parts of California, Washington, and Canada. Authorities in Nepal are investigating why a Soria Airlines flight crashed shortly after taking off from Kathmandu Airport today. 18 people were killed. The pilot was the lone survivor. Rescuers rushed to the scene, and airport officials say most of the passengers were mechanics or airline employees. Witnesses described the moment of the crash.
I came out and saw a plane had crashed, and there was a huge plume of smoke and fire coming out. There was chaos and confusion. We couldn't even go near the plane to help because there was so much fire and even explosions.
Authorities say the aircraft was on its way to another Nepalese city for maintenance. Cybersecurity company CrowdStrike is blaming a bug in an update for last week's global tech outage. It says the bug pushed out bad cybersecurity data to millions of Windows computers, causing crashes that disabled airlines, hospitals, retailers, and more. To prevent future outages, CrowdStrike says it will stagger rollouts of updates, give customers more control over installations, and provide more details about future updates. Among the most affected was Delta Airlines, with more than 6,000 flight cancellations since last Friday. The carrier's CEO said today that operations should return to normal by tomorrow. And on Wall Street today, stocks plummeted after some underwhelming tech earnings. The Dow Industrials fell 500 points, dropping well below the 40,000-point level. The Nasdaq posted its worst session since late 2022, falling more than 650 points. The S&P 500 also tumbled for its fifth drop in the last six sessions. And Olympic officials have announced the hosts for the next two Winter Games, just days before the Summer Olympics in Paris officially kick off. The International Olympic Committee said today that the 2030 Games will be held in the French Alps. And in Utah, crowds rejoiced after news that the Olympics will return in the year 2034. Salt Lake City hosted the Games back in 2002. Also today,
you have the honor of wearing this jacket during the opening ceremony and being a flag bearer with LeBron James.
Team USA selected tennis phenom Coco Gauff to be a flag bearer at Friday's opening ceremony in Paris. The reigning U.S. Open champ had to sit out the Tokyo Games after testing positive for COVID. At 20 years old, Gauff will be the youngest American to carry the flag at an opening ceremony. And still to come on the NewsHour, COVID infections spike nationwide, raising concerns of yet another summer surge. And Christine Brennan previews the major athletes to watch at the Paris Olympics.
This is the PBS NewsHour. from WETA studios in Washington, and in the West, from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
A COVID summer wave has spread across most of the U.S., and western states are seeing particularly high numbers of infections.
With more people traveling for the summer and gathering in large groups, public health officials are concerned these numbers won't be going down anytime soon. William Brangham has the latest.
That's right. Across 45 states and territories, COVID infections are rising. According to the latest data from the CDC, more than half of those regions are showing high or very high levels of COVID in wastewater samples. This rise is partly due to a number of new variants with particular mutations that make it easier for the virus to spread. For more on what we can expect for the rest of this summer, we are joined again by epidemiologist Caitlin Jedalina. She's the author of the invaluable Substack column called Your Local Epidemiologist. Caitlin Jedalina, so nice to have you back on the program. Help us explain this uptick. Is it, as I mentioned, new variants? Is it our summer behaviors? What's driving this?
Yeah, so there's really a combination of three things that drive our summer waves. One is behavior change. It's really hot outside. People move indoors, and viruses love to spread indoors. Two is COVID just keeps mutating. It's mutating about twice as fast as the flu. And every time a virus mutates, it really finds a way to start chipping away at our immunity wall. And then three is just waning immunity. There's this gradual decrease in protection at about 6 months after a vaccine or previous infection. So all three of these things really means the virus has found plenty of people to infect this summer.
I mean, in addition to the number of infections, we always worry about, is this wave driving hospitalizations and is it driving deaths? What's happening with this current wave?
Right. So right now, the wave of infections is actually higher than we saw last summer. We have a pretty big wave of infections right now. Thankfully, though, while severe disease like hospitalizations and deaths are increasing, they're starting at really low levels and not increasing as quickly as infections. And this is thanks to population level immunity, right? These severe disease rates are just not as high as we saw last summer, even the summer before.
So let's talk a little bit more about that vaccination issue. Does the current booster that's available protect against these new variants? And so if people haven't gotten one in a long time, should they consider that or should they wait?
Yeah, so COVID vaccines really continue to provide additional protection every year. Right when you get the vaccine, they are effective against infection, but imperfect and suboptimal, right? Maybe about 20% additional protection. The big bang for the buck is in severe disease. Protection against hospitalization and ICU is about 60% additional protection. But again, that wanes over time. And so what we're seeing, especially among those over 65 and immunocompromised, if they haven't gotten a vaccine in the past 6 months, you may want to consider one right now. But I would get one pretty quickly because the fall is coming. We are going to have an updated vaccine, and we want at least 4 months between each vaccine dose to work its best.
Let's say somebody does get infected. Are the current tests that are available in drugstores accurately able to identify current infections? And two, what about the rules vis-a-vis isolation?
Right. So COVID-19 at-home antigen tests are still a really great tool. They're very good at telling you when you're very infectious. What I think antigen tests are the best at are telling us when we leave isolation, when we're not infectious anymore. According to the CDC, though, you can leave isolation 24 hours after your fever and your symptoms are improving. But after that time period, then it's recommended for about 5 more days. You still wear a mask. You still test if you go see grandma at the nursing home, because there's definitely some infectious virus that may still be hanging around.
Anecdotally, a lot of people I know have been getting it, and it seems that this new variant is making them quite a bit sicker than it was in past variants. But it seems that most people just sort of treat this as a cold or a flu. It's sort of a passing thing that people are not that concerned about. From your perspective, Is that a good idea? Is that okay that people are starting to view COVID this way?
I think it's a good sign, right? It's great that our hospitals are not overwhelming. It was exhausting back then. But it is important to realize that COVID-19 is still more severe. It's more deadly than the flu, about 30 to 40% higher. And so I really worry about those that are older, over 65, even over 70, those in nursing homes, those with a lot of comorbidities, because that is among those, your immune systems are weaker. And when your immune systems are weaker, it's harder to fight. So we're still approaching with this as it's best to prevent infection in the first place through masks, through ventilation, for example. But if you do get infected, to really isolate so you don't continue spreading it to other people in your community.
All right, Caitlin Gentilina of your local epidemiologist, always good to hear from you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Tonight, President Biden will address the nation from the Oval Office and explain his decision to drop out of the 2024 presidential race.
Meanwhile, Biden's vice president, Kamala Harris, is moving closer to locking up her party's nomination for president, all as she navigates a high-stakes visit from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Our White House correspondent, Laura Barone-Lopez, has been following this and joins us now. So, Laura, the vice president has been in Indianapolis on official duty today, but as you've been reporting, her campaign has really hit the ground running. They are breaking fundraising records. They're forging ahead with rallies and events. What's the latest on those efforts?
Well, today, Amna, Vice President Harris spoke to a historically black sorority, telling them that they could make history with their vote this year, and focusing her attacks on Trump, specifically talking about the threats of his second term.
We must also recognize there are those who are trying to take us backward. You may have seen their agenda. Part of it is called Project 2025. Let's be clear. This represents an outright attack on our children, our families, and our future. These extremists want to take us back, but we are not going back. We are not going back.
You can hear her really making her case against Donald Trump, trying to sharpen her message there, Amna. And she's also been racking up a lot of endorsements from all of the leading Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, who in an op-ed in the New York Times today highlighted Harris's actions on abortion access, saying, quote, "As we saw in the 2022 midterms, abortion bans and attacks on democracy are galvanizing women voters like never before. With Ms. Harris at the top of the ticket leading the way, this movement may become an unstoppable wave." Also today, adding to her momentum, Amna, the DNC Rules Committee voted that they will have their virtual vote to name their Democratic nominee by August 7th, and that if anyone wants to challenge Vice President Harris for that nomination, they need to declare their intent in a matter of 3 days.
Now, Laura, we also know that the vice president did not attend that address to Congress by Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu today. We've seen this issue divide the Democratic Party. How is Vice President Harris navigating this, and how could it impact her run?
So Vice President Harris is going to meet separately with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tomorrow, Amna, but this is a delicate dance for the vice president. She is closely aligned with President Biden on the Israel on Israel and Gaza, and she is going to be trying to help him as he attempts to close a deal during the remainder of his presidency. And the White House is saying that they feel as though they are close to a ceasefire deal. But my producer, Shrey Poppet, and I caught up with one of the leaders of that uncommitted movement, those uncommitted voters in states like Michigan, like Leila El Abed, who say that she believes that Harris at the top of the ticket could turn the page on the war in Gaza, and she has the ability to rebuild trust with a lot of these young voters and uncommitted voters who are upset with President Biden's position on the war.
Meanwhile, Laura, as we saw in our latest PBS News NPR Marist polling, there are still a number of voters who have not yet made up their minds. Some 9% say they're undecided. How is Harris's campaign looking at them, and how will they try to persuade them?
So just like our poll on the focus groups that we've sat in on with swing voters show that a lot of those voters don't necessarily know that much about Vice President Harris. And in a memo sent by campaign chair Jen O'Malley Dillon, who has stayed on as chair for Harris's campaign, she said that this dynamic could help Democrats grow their map, saying, quote, in a highly polarized electoral environment, this shift in the race opens up additional persuadable voters. This race is now more fluid. The vice president is well known, but less well known than both Trump and President Biden, particularly among Dem-leaning constituencies. So she's saying there that the universe is now much more wide open for the types of voters that Harris could win. And also Harris is racking up notable endorsements from some former Republicans, like former Lieutenant Governor of Georgia, Jeff Duncan, who told me that he is fully behind her and will go out there and campaign for her, Amna.
Lauren, the minute or so we have left, we know we expect to hear from President Biden tonight, speaking from the Oval Office, the first time since he decided to end his reelection bid. What do we expect to hear from him?
The president is expected to outline why he decided to drop out, Amna, and talk about this inflection point for the country. And according to excerpts of planned remarks that we have, he is expected to say that the defense of democracy is more important than any title that he might hold. That the great thing about America is that here kings and dictators do not rule, the people rule. He's going to say that history is in the public's hands and that America lies in their hands. He said that he ultimately decided the best way forward was to pass the torch. And also his press secretary today, Karine Jean-Pierre, said that his decision was not based on his health at all, and that the president did actually feel that he could serve out a second term.
And we'll have full special coverage around the president's remarks later tonight. That is Laura Barrón-López reporting from the White House. Laura, thank you.
Thank you.
And for more analysis on the rapidly changing state of the presidential race, we're joined now by Democratic strategist Faz Shakir and Republican strategist Kevin Madden. It's great to have you both here.
Great to be with you.
So, Faz, VP Harris could hardly have hoped for a better start in establishing herself among Democrats after President Biden abandoned his bid for the 2024 election. I mean, just judging from her historic fundraising haul and the apparent level of enthusiasm, what's your assessment of this transition, this handing of the baton from Biden to Harris?
Yeah, you're right that it's gone smoothly and that as a campaign manager, you've got to feel really good about, you've got all the tactics lined up to run a very aggressive race against Donald Trump. Now, let's think about the challenges, because that's what they have to deal with. At the end of the day, Jeff, voters decide this race. So as much money as you want, as much delegates as you want, those are all good, but the voters are going to decide. And when you look at the electoral map, she's got to think about Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Nevada, Arizona. Those are going to be critical. Georgia. And, you know, the map is starting to change, as we were hearing here, that the persuadable voter universe could be large for her. And you could either think of her as Obama 3.0. Remember Obama? In 2008, he wins places like North Carolina, Indiana, Ohio. He expanded the map. Why did he win? Because he got a lot of young voters, a lot of new voters who voted for Obama. You could also think of her as Hillary 2.0. What happened in Hillary, right? Here's a person who's also well-known, who goes in, loses Michigan, loses Wisconsin by small margins, loses to Pennsylvania. And I think how you see her, right, is she closer to Obama, is she closer to Hillary, I think would assess the challenges that you're trying to address at this moment. I would say you need to think about the fact that a lot of the voters right now in a generic Democratic ballot are still not sold on her, and she's got to think as if she's playing from behind, and she's got to have a pitch to a lot of these voters to get them enthusiastic beyond the core Democratic base.
And Kevin, at this point, how does the Trump campaign pivot? Because they had a very specific strategy calibrated for a very specific candidate, Joe Biden. How do they make that move now, especially if Kamala Harris is competitive in states where Joe Biden wasn't?
Well, I think first they have to move more quickly. You would have expected that with the developments over the last month, that the Trump campaign or somebody inside the Trump campaign would have had the job of saying, okay, if this is not going to be Joe Biden and we're going to potentially face the undercard on the ticket here, Kamala Harris at the top of the ticket, then we have to immediately be prepared. We have to be prepared to immediately go out there and put a frame around Kamala Harris, tie her to this administration's record on immigration, tie it to the administration's record on the economy and inflation. all issues right now that are not pointed favorably for the administration. I think they were somewhat slow in doing that. You've seen a little bit of more of a stunted message from, and a message that's sort of been competitive depending on which Republicans you've heard from. So I think they really do have to go. I think Dave McCormick out in Pennsylvania put out an ad yesterday in the swing state of Pennsylvania that really did draw that very a harsh contrast frame around Kamala Harris. Everything from the economy to energy to healthcare to national security. And I think they have to make sure that they do that relentlessly over the next 100 days of this campaign, because you do not want to allow Kamala Harris and that campaign to take this momentum and really sort of reintroduce herself to these voters. They want to make sure that they do that before she does.
And Faz, how does her selection of a vice presidential candidate, how does that affect things? And who among the reported shortlist do you think has the best shot here?
Well, I'm not always certain that vice presidents swing elections. I'll say that as a caveat. That said, I think the battlegrounds we know exist. And so when you think of these people like Mark Kelly from Arizona, or Josh Shapiro from Pennsylvania, or Gretchen Whitmer from Michigan, they make sense because you need to, there's those states that you must have. That said, I would think more importantly about the issues of what is the frame that she wants to tell voters about who she is and who complements that frame. To answer, you know, what Kevin was teeing up, she's onto the frame of she's a prosecutor. And I think it's a good framework to think about how you're going to hold government accountable, how you're going to prosecute things on behalf on the economy to improve people's lives. You're going to fight for abortion rights. You're going to fight on democracy rights as with a prosecutorial mindset against Trump. So I think who's that person who's her, who's riding cockpit, who both emphasizes those qualities and balances out things that aren't necessarily there, who's been a governor, who's been somebody who's had to be at the top of legislating, who helps build relationships across the aisle. So I imagine that that's the way she's thinking about it. I couldn't tell you who I think is the best person at this moment.
Well, Kevin, as Vice President Harris seeks to define herself as the potential likely nominee, she is facing a barrage of attacks, some of which have been racist and sexist on their face. Republicans referring to her as a DEI hire. Mm-hmm. I think one of the most frequent lines I've heard from Republicans is to say that she's a San Francisco liberal. And here is how former President Trump during a rally today in Charlotte, here is how he tried to characterize her and her record.
For 3.5 years, Lion Kamala Harris has been the ultra-liberal driving force behind every single Biden catastrophe. She is a radical left lunatic who will destroy our country. If she ever gets the chance to get into office, we're not going to let that happen.
So does that resonate with independent potential swing voters?
Well, look, I think the issues that are going to resonate with those independent voters, what we know about these swing voters right now is that they do care about immigration, they do care about the economy, and they're particularly worried about when it comes to the economy, about things like housing and inflation. So presenting Kamala Harris as somebody who is outside the mainstream on all of those issues, totally fair game, the right message. I actually think the messenger here is the wrong messenger. Donald Trump at the top of the ticket should not be focused on the negative message as much as J.D. Vance should. That's one of the things that J.D. Vance is really going to have to step up, is carry that harder-edged message for the president so he can talk directly to these voter concerns about the economy, about inflation, about immigration, and he can do so in a way that's going to be more persuasive for those swing voters.
And lastly, Faz, we saw progressives really circle the wagons around President Biden when other Democrats were calling for him to exit the race, namely Bernie Sanders and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Senator Sanders has not yet endorsed VP Harris. What's he waiting for?
Well, we need to know what she's going to run on. I mean, the substance matters. And if you look at what the progressive movement has stood for the last few years, Jeff, and you think about Build Back Better, the rescue plan, stimulus, where did those come from? Where do we get cancel student debt from? It's the progressive movement. And it has been the role of the progressive movement to say, elections, yes, hold power, yes, do something with power. And so you see Senator Sanders and a number of others saying, John Fain of the UAW saying, tell me what you stand for. I want to go back to people and say, you're the right choice. I want to vote for you because you're going to do X as president of the United States. Help me fill that in. So you see, even on whether it's Gaza, whether it's what does she want to do about the economy, she's, you know, like I mentioned, she's got opportunities to fill in the blank for people. And they're asking, let's fill in this blanks.
Faz Shakir and Kevin Madden, thanks as always. Appreciate it. And remember, tonight you can watch our live coverage of President Biden's address to the nation right here on PBS. That starts at 8 p.m. Eastern. For years, experts have warned about a growing mental health crisis among America's young people. But within that trend, there are important signals about racial disparities. Between the years 2018 and 2022, the suicide rate among black youth rose by more than 50%, for the first time surpassing white youth, who saw a 17% decline. Special correspondent Fred DeSam Lazaro has this story from Chicago, the first of two reports. It's part of our Race Matters coverage. And a warning, this story discusses topics of suicide that may be difficult for some viewers.
He had a personality that was so contagious. He was so in love with being a good person.
From an early age, Jamal Clay wanted to be helpful.
Some of my fondest memories of Jamal is remember him waking me up early in the morning so we can get to school a little bit before the kids so that he could take the chairs off the desk and help the teachers, you know, prepare for school.
He looked everyone in the eye and gave them his undivided attention. As time went on, however, Rafia Maxie Cole noticed changes in her son. He drew into himself, grew quieter, spent more time alone. Maxie Cole knew Clay was teased at school over his body type. At one point, he tried to take his own life and was rushed to the hospital.
A social worker, mother, traumatized, figuring out which role I have. Well, my 12-year-old is in an isolation unit.
Clay was ultimately released from the hospital, but in the years that followed, his struggles widened.
Many of the struggles that my son dealt with was, of course, being a product of a single parent and not having the closest relationship with his father, trying to be the man of the house, because he was. There was no male, and not knowing how that goes. I remember him telling me, I learned how to tie my tie, Ma, by going on YouTube. And that broke my heart.
On May 27th, 2020, Jamal Clay died by suicide at the age of 19.
It rocked my whole foundation. Because how do you go to work? And one of your main jobs is to keep people safe. And you ain't got nobody safe at your home. I have so many questions, and he has all the answers.
Between 2015 and 2021, more than 360 black people died by suicide in Chicago. According to a University of Chicago study, the trends in that time largely mirrored what happened nationally. Black residents were the only group to experience significant increases in suicides among both men and women. Meanwhile, suicides decreased among white men and women. There was also a higher proportion of suicide deaths among black teens, and the youngest person to die by suicide was an 8-year-old black boy. Professor Janelle Goodwill co-authored that research at the University of Chicago.
I have had the opportunity to directly ask people, particularly black young adults, why they've considered ending their lives. And one of the primary reasons they've pointed to is feeling hopeless about the future. Hopelessness on an individual level, but also hopelessness on a structural level.
Chicago has been called one of America's most segregated cities, and the disparities are striking. Even though blacks account for fewer than a third of this city's residents, they make up nearly half of those living in poverty, 70% of people in jail, and 3/4 of all victims of gun violence.
How much of those contributing factors, how much of those are at the baseline of the cumulative problem that you have?
Yeah, I think that's a really important word that you use, is cumulative. There's rarely one reason that leads someone to consider suicide. It's not just these individual level factors like stigma, but these larger systemic or structural level factors that are shaping an individual's ability to have access to clean air, to quality schools, to adequate health care. Do they have access to quality foods? And do they have a strong social safety net and support?
In 2019, the Congressional Black Caucus released a report on the national crisis with recommendations for tackling it, including increased funds to research the rise in black youth suicide. The National Institute of Mental Health has since granted millions of dollars for the effort.
As a Black person, as a youth, you must have these blinders on, just like a horse in a race, because you can't look left and right. You just have to keep forward.
It's our duty!
Maxie Cole notes her son died just 2 days after George Floyd was murdered by police in Minneapolis. She says living in a society rife with systemic and structural racism is like having a headache that never goes away. And she says a stereotype of endless resilience within the Black community can be taxing.
I'm so sick and tired of being Black and gotta be strong. Be Black and be a strong woman. You can survive. I'm tired. Everything in this house represents struggle. It represents somebody who came from up and under. And I get that. I lean on that. But sometimes you get mad because it feels unfair. It's like my child is dead, but I still gotta be strong, you know? I will never see my son do those things.
After her son's death, Maxie Cole created an organization, Soul Survivors of Chicago. She advocates for suicide prevention and mental health awareness, hoping to tackle what she sees as enduring stigma in the community.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Soul Survivors also provide support for people of color who've lost loved ones to suicide.
Welcome, welcome to the show. Breaking the Silence, provided by Soul Survivors of Chicago.
Maxie Cole hosts a public access talk show where she speaks to guests about mental health.
You can see my life and what I'm doing with it to normalize the conversation about this happening and what happens when this happens and what we feel. I take on the charge and wave the flag. Does it hurt? Hell yes. Do I like it? Not always. But I'm here to say I will stand in that place so that you don't have to imagine.
Earlier this year, on an episode of Breaking the Silence, Maxie Cole interviewed Noah Boynton, a 17-year-old from Chicago's South Side. Boynton spoke about his own mental health struggles and the help he eventually received. Tomorrow night, we will share Noah Boynton's story and explore how a shortage of mental health providers is exacerbating this crisis. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSamlazaro in Chicago.
And Fred's reporting is a partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota.
All right, well, the 2024 Paris Olympics are here. The opening ceremony isn't until Friday, but events are officially underway today, including men's soccer and rugby. Millions of fans will descend on the city, as will athletes from around the globe, including American superstars like Simone Biles, Sha'Carri Richardson, LeBron James, Coco Gauff, and Katie Ledecky. To preview the Summer Games, I am joined from Paris by Christine Brennan, columnist for USA Today. Christine, great to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Amna, great to be with you. Thank you.
So before we dive into this game, I have to just ask you about some Olympics-related news out today. The International Olympic Committee announced that the 2034 Winter Games will be hosted by Salt Lake City, but there's been some controversy around that decision. Explain that to us.
Exactly. You know, Salt Lake City is really the only city that wanted the 2034 Games. They're very controversial, cost a lot of money. We expected this, Amna, to just be a slam dunk. Instead, the IOC, several members, brought up basically a demand, demanding the local officials in Utah and Salt Lake City, including the governor, accede to their wishes to shut down the federal investigation that's going on involving the Chinese doping controversy that I'm sure many remember and have heard of about involving swimming. The U.S., the FBI is investigating. There's a law called the Rodchenkov Act that actually allows the United States to investigate doping schemes that affect U.S. athletes, which this one certainly does, and maybe deprives them of medals. And so, surprisingly, shockingly, the U.S. officials said, yes, we will sign this agreement with the knowledge that we are now been told by the IOC that we should try to shut down an investigation that would impact the IOC, because if they come into the country, as has been the case with one official, where they get subpoenaed when they land in the United States, and these International Olympic Committee people, Amna, they think they're royalty, and they think they're untouchable, and they don't want to deal with U.S. laws. Truly stunning development that they caved in to the IOC in this manner.
Not the headline they wanted to kick off these games, but let's turn to these summer events ahead now. They're featuring some of the biggest U.S. stars folks will know, including gymnast Simone Biles, truly the GOAT. Now, we have to remind folks, Team USA took the silver last Olympics. We remember Biles had to pull out amid extreme stress that was actually putting her in physical risk. How do we expect her to do and the team this year?
This is the story of the Olympics, at least for U.S. fans, for sure, and gymnastics fans. Simone Biles, of course, is a survivor of the worst sexual abuse case and scandal in Olympic history and in sports history, the Larry Nassar saga. And she's been so vocal as a survivor and supporting others, those hundreds of women who were just horrifically abused. And so she's a survivor. She's the greatest of all time, as you said. She is coming back after a terrific Olympics in Rio 8 years ago. And then, of course, a difficult Olympics 3 years ago in Tokyo. She had the twisties, a word we all didn't know, and then we all knew. And she withdrew to take care of that physically, mentally, came back, won the bronze medal in the balance beam. And here she is now. I wouldn't be surprised at all if she wins the gold in the individual all around. The U.S. gets that team gold back, and she's able to win gold in several of the events, including floor exercise, balance beam, maybe in vault as well. She's 27, but she's on top of her game, Amna, and she really feels great coming into these Olympics and obviously is going to be the one to watch over the next 10 days or so.
Also one to watch, if we head over to the pool now, is Katie Ledecky. She's swimming in her fourth Olympic Games, looking to add to her six individual gold medals. What should we watch for here?
Yeah, I think she's going to win two more individual gold medals in the 800 and the 1500. The longer she swims, the better she does. She's great, of course, at those distances and has dominated the mile, the 1500, and also the 800. The 400 will kick off the Olympic competition on Saturday. There's an Australian, Ariane Titmus, who won the gold 3 years ago. Katie got the silver. So Katie has won gold in Rio in this event, the 400 meters, and then silver. And the question is now, will she win a medal at all? And if she does, will it be a bronze? There's great competition. All these young swimmers who grew up idolizing Katie Ledecky are now competing with her because she, like Simone Biles, is 27. They were born in the same week in March of 1997. Amazing. Ledecky and Biles. So Katie, though, is just such a superb athlete, so good, and loves this so much. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see her win four medals overall, one in the relay, and then three in the 400, 800, 1500 with gold in those last two events.
That was a great week to be born in 1997. All right, what about track and field? We all know superstar names like Sha'Carri Richardson and Noah Lyles. How is Team USA expected to do?
You know, this is really one of the marquee events, and it's the second week of the Olympics after swimming is done and a lot of gymnastics. And Americans love their sprinters. I mean, going all the way back to Jesse Owens, to Carl Lewis, Florence Griffith Joyner, Evelyn Ashford, on and on at Gail Devers, and now Sha'Carri Richardson. She gets that chance that she did not get 3 years ago. I'm sure people remember the positive drug test for marijuana. It broke everyone's heart, but it is a banned substance, so she did not go to the Tokyo Olympics. She's back. She's expected to do great and I think win potentially the 100 meters. And then Noah Lyles on the men's side, the same, those sprints, the 100 and the 200. He won the bronze in Tokyo, and he has just been dominating on the world stage at world championships. So those two, those names that I mentioned earlier, we always look for the next one. We look for that next superstar in the sprints. And I think Richardson and Lyles are definitely going to fit the bill. Obviously, a lot of pressure, but I think they're ready to do it.
Christine Brennan from USA Today joining us from Paris, covering the Olympic Games. Christine, thank you so, so much. We'll check back in with you soon.
Thanks, Anna. Take care.
$40 million people depend on the Colorado River, which irrigates some of the nation's most productive agricultural land. But that vital resource is in peril.
Science correspondent Miles O'Brien looks at the problem and some solutions in a special live stream tonight. You can watch The Tipping Point, Colorado River Reckoning at 7 p.m. Eastern on our YouTube page. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Have a good evening.